Europe is kind of the one and only big developed economic area where China can still buy companies.
Trading tensions rather than products. It's Wednesday, May 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Nepal feels the COVID wave. Australia's space commander. The politics of meat. A famous museum reopens. Hollywood's vintage clothes. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The European Union has suspended efforts to ratify the trade deal it recently forged with Beijing as tensions rise over accusations of gross human rights abuses in China. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
The EU-China Comprehensive Agreement on Investment took 7 years of negotiations and was finally agreed in principle in December. Europe said it was the most ambitious trade deal that China had ever signed. But it's yet to be approved by lawmakers in the European Parliament. The Vice President of the EU Commission said last week that efforts to get it ratified have now been suspended. It follows tit-for-tat sanctions imposed over China's treatment of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang province, which the United States has described as genocide. Washington imposed sanctions on several Beijing officials in March, and the European Union followed with its own measures targeting 4 Chinese officials. China retaliated by sanctioning 5 lawmakers in the European Parliament.
At the end of the day, the ratification happens at the European Parliament. So, you know, in a way, the target was somehow of the sanctions to involved in the decision to ratify.
Analysts say tensions between China and Europe over Xinjiang and the crackdown on the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong mean ratification of the trade deal looks unlikely anytime soon. Germany's leader said the deal should not be abandoned.
Despite all the difficulties that we will certainly encounter in ratification, it is nevertheless a very important initiative that opens up greater reciprocity in access to our reciprocal markets.
The agreement was meant to open China's huge market to European companies. But from the beginning, some European lawmakers saw the deal as deeply flawed.
Every single piece of market access that Europe was getting, when you read the details, is actually not as big.
The investment deal is a key part of China's expansion plans.
Europe is kind of the one and only big developed economic area that where China can still buy companies.
Beijing is pushing Europe to ratify the agreement.
China is willing to communicate and cooperate with EU to promote the realization of deal as early as possible to benefit people from both sides.
Meanwhile, the EU this week unveiled plans to block foreign companies that are supported by state subsidies from buying European businesses or bidding for public contracts. Analysts say that would impact Chinese state-backed companies looking to expand in Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Trade, especially with China, is vastly important to the entire world. We invite you to read more as this story develops on our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, also on Facebook at VOA Asia, and at our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. The World Health Organization says India variant of global concern. Nepal Prime Minister loses vote of confidence in Parliament. 3 Myanmar journalists arrested in Thailand. China population growth falls to lowest rate in decades. Overseas and overlooked, Americans in Thailand seek vaccines. Expanded coverage of these stories and so much more can be found daily at Facebook at VOA Asia. We invite you to stop by our Instagram page, Twitter, and YouTube. Also our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington with more VOA Asia. The deadly second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic ravaging India has now spread across its borders to neighboring Nepal. The small mountain kingdom now confronts a crisis as its healthcare system is buckling under the pressure. Anjana Pasricha has a report.
Seeking a safe haven, thousands of Nepalese migrants working in India fled home as a brutal second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic battered the country with sickness and death. Now Nepal is witnessing similar scenes. Its fragile healthcare system is buckling as infections and deaths spike exponentially.
Almost all hospitals are packed. Some hospitals have some spaces, but we are unable to operationalize almost all of them because of shortage of oxygen and shortage of other logistics.
India and Nepal have open borders, allowing easy mobility between the two countries. While cases first surged in towns along the Indian border, Kathmandu Valley is now the epicenter. Many have fled the city in recent days, raising fears that they will carry the deadly infection into villages.
Number of people dying on searching the hospitals, on the treatment, during the treatments. And another alarming situation that the large number of people are in home isolations. And once they seek for the hospital care, we are not in such a good condition that we can provide their required care.
Many say, like India, Nepal too let down its guard when infections were low, allowing large gatherings. Now, doctors are warning of an impending crisis in a country with very few intensive care beds.
We are underprepared, under-resourced and under-capacitated to perform anything that is expected.
Most flights have been halted and much of the country is in lockdown. Worried residents are lining up for inoculations, but less than 7% has received one dose.
Coronavirus cases are not slowing down. As more people are getting infected and many people are dying, we are stressed as to what we should do and how we can stay safe.
Political turmoil in the country, where Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli lost a confidence vote on Monday, will only add to its woes in coping with the pandemic. China is sending oxygen cylinders, but Nepal has not received the large-scale international medical aid of the kind rushed to India by over 40 countries.
We immediately need international supports. Basically, right now, just for now, we need oxygen supports from international community. Ministry of Health and Populations is unable to address the real situation, real problem in hospitals, real problem in home isolations. We are struggling.
Health officials and doctors fear that without help, the situation will only worsen in the coming days. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, going way up from down under. Happening now in Asia, bodies of suspected COVID-19 patients floating in the Ganges River have triggered panic in several Indian villages. There are concerns from experts that the original number of deaths and cases of coronavirus are far larger than those reported in India. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're having a great day. We hope you are too. And we're glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. A senior female Air Force officer whose childhood idol was iconic Apollo 11 astronaut Neil Armstrong will become Australia's first space commander. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Air Vice Marshal Catherine Roberts will oversee the space activities across Australia's armed forces. Experts have said the Army, Navy and Air Force have relied on space-based technologies and communication, and centralised coordination was sensible. There is growing international competition for supremacy in space. The United States has a military arm called the US Space Force, while China and Russia both set up similar units in 2015. But officials in Canberra have been keen to stress that Australia has no plans to further militarize space, nor would it seek to build technologies to attack enemy satellites. A dedicated space command brings Australia into line with Canada, France, India and Japan. Senior officers have said part of its job would be to establish if satellites used by Australia were under threat or being subjected to accidental interference or natural events. Air Vice Marshal Catherine Roberts is a trained engineer who served with the Royal Australian Air Force for 35 years. She will take up her position as Space Commander next year. In an official RAAF video, she explained how she was inspired by the Apollo 11 moon landing in July 1969.
Today, I wanted to take the opportunity to talk about role models and how important it is for each one of us to pave the way for the next generation as we head into a rapidly accelerating future. The first person I remember ever having a material impact on my ambition was Neil Armstrong. In 1969, as a three-year-old, I watched on in awe as Lieutenant Armstrong descended the ladder of the lunar lander and uttered the first words ever spoken on the moon. It was an incredible moment for humanity and millions of aspiring engineers that were probably created at that moment. I was no different.
Last year, the civilian Australian Space Agency officially opened its new headquarters in the city of Adelaide. It's responsible for developing the nation's multi-billion dollar commercial space industry. The government believes it will generate 20,000 jobs in Australia by 2030. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has previously estimated the global space economy could be worth more than $780 billion by 2040, and that Australia needed to be in a position to take advantage of the opportunities. Analysts have said that as the cost and intricacies of exploiting space have fallen, more countries and businesses are developing and launching the type of surveillance and navigation technology that could have military capabilities. To this end, experts have said there needs to be close cooperation between the civilian-run Australian Space Agency and the planned new military Space Command division that will be led by Air Vice Marshal Roberts. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Around 100 people have marched through the side streets in Myanmar's Yangon, holding banners and flags of ethnic groups that have vowed to fight the military following the February 1st coup. The march marks the 100th day since the military seized power. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. There's much more on VOA Asia. Right now, some Republican lawmakers and conservative commentators are continuing to falsely claim that President Joe Biden's climate plan will force Americans to eat far less red meat. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara looks at how burgers have become the latest battlefield in the country's culture war.
The claim that President Joe Biden wants to ban meat consumption is false and has turned into viral memes. Still, conservatives, including some Republican lawmakers, continue to promote it. The Biden administration has no intention of limiting meat consumption, said Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack.
In the political world, games get played and issues are injected into the conversation, knowing full well that there's not a factual basis for the issue.
It started out with a false headline from a British tabloid that Biden's climate plan could limit Americans to one hamburger a month. That's a lot less than the current average of three burgers a week, according to data from the U.S. Agriculture Department. The article baselessly tied Biden's proposal to tackle climate change to a 2020 University of Michigan study that says cutting Americans' meat consumption in half would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 1.6 billion metric tons by 2030, roughly 25% of America's yearly output. Martin Heller is one of the authors of the study.
That really is a total false connection. You know, we really didn't make any suggestions to a particular policy recommendation. And as far as I know, the Biden administration has not made any reference to our study as well.
With a false claim, meat became a symbol of personal freedom against government tyranny, turning burgers into the latest battlefield in America's culture war.
I think there's a lot of the American West and ranchers and masculinity that the right wants to associate itself with. And so steak and meat has become one of those things.
With increased awareness of the role of food production in climate change, meat consumption may be political. A 2018 Gallup poll shows that 11% of liberals say they are vegetarian, compared with 2% of conservatives. But there's no danger of the country going meatless anytime soon. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, an American eats an average of 37 kilograms of beef per year. However, they are also increasingly turning to plant-based alternatives, now commonly found in restaurants and supermarkets.
It tastes just like a burger.
Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, China's population growth has fallen to its lowest rate in decades. China says its population grew by 72 million people to 1.41 billion in the decade ending in 2020, its lowest population increase since imposing a strict one-child-per-family policy in the 1980s. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after more than a year in shutdown brought on by the pandemic, eight Smithsonian Museum facilities in and around Washington are reopening this month. VOA's Julie Tabo takes a look.
The Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, has reopened its doors for the first time since closing for the coronavirus pandemic last year. It's the first of eight Smithsonian museums that are reopening this month, with pandemic-related safety measures in place, such as limited-time entries, the use of face coverings, and social distancing. The Udvar-Hazy Center is larger than its companion facility, the National Air and Space Museum on the National Mall in Washington.
It has the large artifacts, the big aircraft that couldn't fit downtown. And so it presents them more in a hangar-style format where people can just look at the artifacts, soak them in, and kind of bring their experiences.
On display for the first time are two historic objects that commemorate the reopening of the museum, as well as the 60th anniversary of the first American spaceflight. An F-18 Hornet jet fighter that was flown by the famous Blue Angels Navy Squadron, and the capsule that carried the first American into space, which helped launch the American space program.
The addition of new artifacts on display or acquisitions like the Blue Angels Hornet or the Freedom 7 capsule, that allows us to tell these big stories.
Also on display are the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird, the fastest jet aircraft in the world. This space shuttle Discovery, the longest-serving, oldest surviving space shuttle, and the Enola Gay, the B-29 that dropped the atomic bomb over Hiroshima, Japan during World War II. Visitors of all ages enjoyed both the old and the new.
Our granddaughter loves it here. I open space, all the airplanes roaming around. She gets to see a lot of history. She's only 3.5 years old, and she is already informing us of what some of these planes did in the past and so forth. So it's pretty amazing.
We just wanted to get out since we've kind of been cooped up during COVID to let the boys experience being outside, being in the museum, and seeing some of the wonderful airplanes.
We love looking at airplanes. A couple times we've seen the Blue Angels fly in the sky, and it's cool to see the history of all the different planes as they evolved throughout the years, and maybe pique their interest in becoming a pilot in the future if they wanted to become one, or even an astronaut.
Six more Smithsonian museums and the National Zoo are scheduled to reopen later this month.
Yay!
They include the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the National Portrait Gallery, the Smithsonian American Art Museum and its Renwick Gallery,
the National Museum of American History, and the National Museum of the American Indian.
I've always felt that you can tell so much about a nation by what it remembers, and even more by what it forgets. So I want to make sure the Smithsonian helps America remember not just what it wants, but what it needs to remember.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
The Smithsonian, of course, contains many vintage artifacts. When Hollywood needs an authentic Victorian dress or Edwardian hat for a new movie, costume designers are likely to head to New York City and go straight to vintage collector Helen Ufner. The 72-year-old fashionista has provided clothing for over 1,000 movies, theater productions, and fashion shows over the past 45 years. Nina Vishneva has her story, narrated by Anna Rice.
If you want to try it on.
A treasured trove of vintage clothing includes hats Rachel Brosnahan wore in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the cardigan Tom Hanks sported in The Bridge of Spies, and the nightgown Angelina Jolie had on in The Original Sin. More recent garb of note includes clothes lent to costume designers for U.S. vs. Billie Holiday and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which won an Oscar for Best Costume Design in 2021.
You have a camisole, you'd have bloomers, you would have a corset, you would have several layers of petticoats, and then the dress would go over you.
Helen Ufner is founder of Helen Ufner Vintage Clothing, the largest private collection of apparel from yesteryear in the U.S. Tens of thousands of clothing items and accessories span from the Victorian era to the bright neon of 1980s.
In 1982, Woody Allen was doing the movie Zelig, and he went into a boutique in Soho looking for 1920s clothing. So they came up to my apartment. I only had one rack. It was in the bedroom of me and my boyfriend at the time. And they bought everything I had.
Ufner started collecting vintage back when she was young. She would save money looking after the neighbor's babies. She started with vintage books, then switched to rings. Then came clothing. She says her love for vintage stems from a lack of family heirlooms. During Second World War, her parents fled Poland and came to Belgium. Most of her family died in concentration camps.
I love old things. They speak to me. You know, they have a history. Somebody loved them at one time. I'm not as interested in new fashion.
She would find vintage gems and sell them. But the more she hunted down unique pieces, the less she wanted to part with them. That's when she started renting out her precious possessions to costume designers, directors, fashion show organizers. After the filming comes to an end, actors are supposed to return the clothing they used, but sometimes they don't.
We supplied a lot of things to The Irishman, and two of the things we supplied were for Robert De Niro. It was a pair of pajamas, and I think there's a scene where he's in pajamas all the time, and a robe. But we didn't get it back.
Clothing is subject to wear and tear on set. The Titanic crew couldn't guarantee they would be able to return all pieces intact, and Ufner decided not to risk it.
So I didn't do the movie. And later I found out that they had a lot of ruined items.
Broadway, Hollywood, TV studios, and fashion shows. Demand is high for Ufner's precious collection. For 45 years, Ufner has played a critical role in 1,000 movies, theater productions, and other projects. Her passion for vintage earned her clients 4 Emmys and an Oscar, as well as a variety of other awards. The pandemic slowed business, which is now picking up again. Ufner's pieces are starting to get rented out.
Y'all ready?
Slowly and cautiously. For Nina Vishnova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. Continue online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to listen again tomorrow at the same time. And we thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.